So here I am at the lovely offices in St Albans of our legal experts and advertising partners, Debenhams Ottaway. Today I'm going to be talking with Michael Kerrigan. He's an associate solicitor here. He specialises in employment law. So what better subject to talk about than what to expect in an employment tribunal? Michael, where do we start?
There's quite a lot to get through. I thought it'd be useful just to give a summary of the life of an employment tribunal claim right from the very beginning, nice, when the claim is issued, all the way through how the case is managed by the tribunal, and then on to the actual final hearing and how that's conducted. So, people may not be familiar with the employment tribunal. It's very different in terms of the way things are managed from civil courts, which people may have experienced. There may be some similarities, but then there are some differences as well. So it tends to be a bit more relaxed and a bit more informal in the way that they do things, and a bit more flexible in how they can react to the type of claim that they're dealing with. So what happens during the life of a claim? How do you start off a claim is probably the most important place to start. There is a compulsory stage which has been introduced since 2014, which is called ACAS pre-claim conciliation. And what that essentially means is that the parties have to consult with ACAS, who are a conciliation body, before they can actually formally submit a claim to the employment tribunal.
Is that like some kind of mediation?
Exactly, that's exactly correct. So this was introduced to try and resolve as many claims as possible before they actually get to the employment tribunal to reduce the traffic. Mm. Now, what that means is that you have a set time that you need to bring a claim and issue the claim in. And that's normally 3 months. Now, you have to actually contact ACAS within that three-month period. And what they do is essentially the clock stops at that stage in terms of the time limits. And they then have a four-week consultation period where they would contact both parties and try and reach a resolution. If a resolution can't be reached, then the claim would be issued with a certificate and a unique number, which they then need to quote when they eventually go on to issue the ET1, which is the actual claim form itself. Right. So once you've been through the ACAS pre-claim process, let's proceed on the basis that it hasn't been resolved. Yeah. Although it has been a bit of a success in terms of increasing the amount of claims which are resolved at that stage. So you've got your certificate number. You can then go on to issue the ET1 form, which is the claim form within the employment tribunal. At this stage, you have to pay a fee. The claim fees for an unfair dismissal claim, which is the most common type of claim which is brought, is £250. That's to start the claim off. And then later on, when you get to a final hearing, you have to pay a further fee of £950. For less complex cases, for example, claiming unpaid wages, that would be a fee of £160 at this stage, and then a fee of £230 for the hearing.
If you have to pay all these fees up front, and for example, if you know you haven't got that kind of money, is that all factored into the cost if you were then representing someone in helping them make a claim?
Well, there is a remission scheme in place, so if you meet certain criteria, then you don't have to pay the fee. But it is incredibly complex, and that's one of the criticisms of the fee regime, is that it's discouraging people from bringing claims which may have good prospects, mm-hmm. but they're being put off by issuing particularly lower value claims. If you are successful in your claim, then you would have the court fees repaid as part of the compensation package, but it still deters people from actually starting off the claim process, which is disappointing. Now, the ET1 stage is very, very important, because this is where you have to essentially set out your claim. So it's very important that you do so in a clear and concise way. And obviously, we'd suggest that you get legal advice at that stage just to make sure that it's as focused and correct as it should be in terms of the legal issues. Mm. Now, when the claim is actually submitted to the tribunal, they actually have the power at this stage to review all the cases that come in, and anything which they think has a limited prospect of success or very low prospects of success, they can actually strike out at that stage. So what they're essentially saying is this claim doesn't meet the minimum criteria to be a successful case, so therefore it's referred to as the sift stage. So they sift through all the cases effectively and look at the prospects. Anything which is very low, they can actually reject the claim at that stage. Okay, so once the claim has been issued and has been accepted by the tribunal, it would then be sent to the respondent, who is normally the employer at this stage, and that's referred to as the ET3 stage. So the employer then has 28 days to submit their ET3 response, which is essentially their defence mm-hmm. to the claim. So once the ET1 and ET3 have been submitted, what the tribunal would normally do at that stage then is contact both parties and try to schedule directions for how the case is going to be managed moving forward. Now, what they can do at this stage, and is becoming increasingly common, is to schedule a preliminary hearing. And what that is essentially used by the tribunal to narrow down the issues that there may be between the parties that have been raised in the ET1 or ET3 forms. Should the case even continue? So again, the respondent at that stage can actually contest whether the claim has strong enough prospects of success to actually continue. And then there would also be some consideration of the general administration of the case. So administrative issues such as how many witnesses are there likely to be, how long is the case likely to last at the final hearing, and that then just helps the tribunal to actually schedule the timetabling of the case moving forward. Okay, so what we then have are what's known as directions. So the tribunal would write to the various parties and tell them what the timetable is for the case. So obviously they would list the final hearing date at this stage, and then in between they would then list a number of requirements for the parties to meet and when that needs to be done by. So it's essentially setting the timetable for the parties to prepare for the final hearing. Now, that's based on a number of issues, including how complex the case is likely to be, whether or not there are specific issues that need to be dealt with by the parties, but there are some core directions which we always have in tribunal cases. So firstly, there's a disclosure stage, which is where the parties have to look at the evidence and documents that they have in their possession and show those to the other side. Now, this can be quite difficult for people to get their heads around, because you also have to show them documents which help your case, but also those which hinder your case or may help the other side. So it can be quite difficult to explain that to your client, because they obviously don't want to volunteer information to the other side which may help the other side's case. But that's the way that litigation is conducted, and it's essentially almost like playing cards with the cards face up, if you like. So the disclosure stage is very useful for the parties to understand what documents are in the other side's possession and therefore how strong their case or defence is likely to be. After you have the disclosure stage and the parties have all of the documents which are relevant to the case, they would then agree on a bundle of documents, which essentially is a core bundle of all the relevant documents, which is then paginated so it is numbered in a clear and sensible fashion, which allows the parties then to refer to documents easily during the case. After the bundle has been agreed, the parties would then normally be required to submit witness statements, which is done in writing, and the parties would normally be required to exchange those simultaneously so that neither party gains an advantage from having a look at the other side's witness statements before they've drafted their own. Now, in terms of witnesses, if there are issues whereby a witness is refusing to attend and they may have relevant information, then the tribunal can be asked to prepare a witness order, which is almost like a summons in the county court, which would require a person to attend at the tribunal to give their evidence. Another document which is very important, which the claimant would be asked to prepare, is a schedule of loss. And that's a very interesting document, because what it does is it forces the claimant to actually think about what their losses are likely to be and to clearly set that out so that the other side can see exactly what the value of the claim is. Okay, so once the parties have been through that process of getting together all the documents and complying with the relevant directions, they should then be ready for the final hearing. And the way that the directions are set out, it just leads nicely up to it, the tribunal hearing in a logical fashion. Now, throughout this time, ACAS is always there in the background, and they have there is the option there for ACAS to conciliate at any time. So what they tend to do is to contact the parties at the beginning of the claim when the ET1 has been formally issued, and then they just remain there in the background. So they normally tend to touch base throughout the life of the case just to see how things are progressing, to see whether there is the option to try and negotiate any form of settlement. And if either party does want to try and negotiate a settlement at any point, they can do that via ACAS. So we've had our directions, we're ready for the final hearing, so how does that work? Well, as I mentioned earlier on, there is a further fee to be paid by the claimants at this point, depending on the type of claim that it is. It's just to remind you again, it tends to be less formal in the employment tribunal, so parties can represent themselves if they wish to do so, but normally you would have a solicitor that prepares the case for you, and then we would instruct a barrister to actually represent the claimant or the respondent on the day in the employment tribunal. How long the case is listed for depends on how complex it is and how long the tribunal thinks it will take to actually get through the issues. Now, the actual panel, the way that the panel is structured, depends on the complexity of the case, but you would always have an employment tribunal judge, And they then may or may not have two lay members, who are also referred to as wing members, to assist them. That would tend to be in more complex cases that they would have the lay members. The wingmen, exactly. For more simple cases, either on legal or factual issues, they would tend to sit alone. The lay members, they would normally tend to be one employer-friendly person and one employee-friendly person. So the employer-friendly person would normally be someone from an HR-type background. The employee-friendly individual would normally be from a trade union background, for example. So in terms of how they sit, they tend to sit between the hours of 10 and 4, breaking for an hour for lunch. So there's not a huge amount of time to get through the issues. It sounds like a fairly long amount of time, but you'd be surprised how quickly that goes on the day. The parties call their various witnesses, and the other side would have the opportunity to actually cross-examine those witnesses on the day. So that either, for example, the barrister would be able to cross-examine, ask questions of the other side's witness to try and challenge the accuracy of their evidence. Mm-hmm. The judge has the option to ask questions. It can be quite informal at times, with the judge interrupting to ask particular questions, and the lay members can also ask questions if they wish to do so. So once the parties have called their witnesses and we've been through the witness evidence, each party then has an opportunity to go through closing submissions. And that's essentially where they summarise their case. Each party takes it in turn and they try and pull together all of their case, all of their legal arguments, also try and pick holes in the other side's claim as best they can. And then that's it. That brings the formal final hearing to a close. Now, it is possible for the judge to give judgment there and then if they have time to do so, but quite often we have what's known as a reserve judgment, where the judge essentially says that they'll notify the parties in writing. That obviously can create some tension in waiting to hear the outcome. It is always obviously preferable for everything to be dealt with there and then, but because of the restrictions in terms of time, it quite often is impossible to get to the actual judgment stage as well. So once you get your judgment in the post, you then find out whether you've won the case or not. You then there is the possibility then to have a remedies hearing. So if the claimant has won and they haven't had time to actually deal with the issue of remedies at the final hearing stage, they may actually schedule another hearing to deal with remedies, i.e. compensation. So what should the winning party be awarded? What happens in relation to the costs? That's often a question that people ask. So outside of the court fees, there can be significant legal costs involved, depending on how complex the case is. Now, interestingly, in the employment tribunal, costs don't actually follow the event. Now, what I mean by that is that in the civil courts, normally if you win the case, the other side pays the majority of your fees. But in the employment tribunal, each party bears their own costs. So you have to factor that into the cost of litigation. So generally speaking, even if you win, you won't get any costs from the other side. The only exception to that is where one party's deemed to have behaved really badly in terms of the litigation. So that could be whether if they've brought a claim which had no prospects of success whatsoever, or they've behaved badly in terms of, for example, not disclosing key documents, which has made the process a lot more difficult or adversarial. So, but it's very rare that costs are awarded. So that's something that people need to factor in when they're actually considering whether to bring a claim or not, whether they can actually afford to bear the cost of those fees, and whether it's economically sensible and proportionate to the amount in dispute. I wasn't going to discuss appeals because it is quite a complex area in and of itself, and we could address that on another day as part of another talk. Now, just going back to fees, as I mentioned at the outset, this is quite a controversial issue. It's been going on ever since fees were introduced. So prior to the fees being brought in, it was actually free to issue an employment tribunal claim. Now, it was felt that led to a lot of frivolous claims being brought simply because there wasn't an obvious cost to claimants at that initial stage. Now, since the introduction of fees, there has been quite a dramatic impact on the amount of claims which are being brought, and that has led people to question whether there is sufficient access to justice now. So are people with genuine claims being put off, and is this encouraging employers to behave unreasonably towards their staff because they know they're less likely to issue claims because of the costs involved? Interestingly, in the last couple of days, there has been a review published by the government where they have looked into the matter of fees. And rather interestingly, they seem to think that the fees aren't such a bad thing, and actually the original objectives of introduction of fees have been reasonably met. which is interesting because there has been a number of judicial review applications around fees, and it's an issue that's likely to carry on in the near future in terms of people objecting to fees and raising issues about access to justice.
See, for me, I can understand why they impose the fees. I can understand that. But if then you're knocking off a whole section of the public that are really in low paid jobs that are getting unfairly dismissed, they can't afford to do anything about it.
Yes, as you say, it does seem to disproportionately affect the lower paid individuals, because where someone has a high value claim, they're not going to be so concerned about the fees because it's obviously proportionate. A lot of people are actually saying that the balance is wrong, so they don't necessarily disagree with the introduction of fees, but they think that perhaps the fee levels are too high. So you could have a lower fee scheme which would still encourage people to only bring valuable claims or claims with merit, but would not discourage those lower earners. Mm. So I think that the introduction of fees was a good idea, but I think that they've perhaps got the balance wrong, and that's something that needs to be addressed. And it is entirely possible that that will be addressed moving forward, because there is a consultation ongoing at the moment with the government to actually get some feedback and get some ideas as to what can be done to the fees regime to perhaps make it fairer.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great talking to you today. And if anybody is concerned about being unfairly dismissed at work, then I guess they can just check out your website or give you a call.
Yes, that's right. It goes for both employers and employees. Whether you wish to bring an ET claim or whether you are the subject of an ET claim, it's very important to get some focused advice to make sure that you put forward the best possible claim or defence that you can. It can be quite difficult when you come to us later on within the process where errors have already been made to, for example, the claim or the defence, for us to actually correct that. So it's important to get early advice, focused specialist advice, to make sure that you stand the best chance of success.